Hello, welcome to Diving Into the Wreckage with me and Sean. Farmville Antifada collaboration that we've been doing now for, 2 years.
2 years. That's great. I've been having a lot of fun with it. It's a good break from, you know, the other stuff that, we've all been doing. I think Boundless and Bottomless is kind of a hit for me, too. I'm really enjoying reading the Dugan with you and Jason.
Yeah, it's funny because I think people are like, Boundless and Bottomless is a Dugan show. And I'm like, we're going to be doing Dugan a lot. But once we're done with this book and I do a couple supplementary episodes on a few other elements of Dugan, we're done for a while because I got to cover other right-wing thinkers. Including more normie ones. Like,
yeah, we could do one on Sohrab Ahmari.
Yeah, Sohrab's an interesting character because he's a guy we both actually know.
Yeah,
I personally like him.
Yeah,
but I think also he's a totally sincere actor. Which also means that his major shifts in his conservatism and his leftism at different points of his life are fascinating to me. Because with him, you have a guy who's gone from being a trot to being a neoconservative to being a
post-integralist.
Yeah, a post-integralist who's aggressive with neoconservatives for their compromises on the culture war.
Yeah.
To whatever the hell he's doing now.
Also, he passed through like a heroic phase of like dissident right because he had a big public scrape with that father of. Not father, but one of the main progenitors of like modern centrist conservatism, David French.
French, yeah. I was actually thinking that.
Or whatever they call them.
David French was too concessionary to liberals, too much of a Straussian, etc. I think this is interesting, though. I mean, it's interesting talking about these other shows, but how this is relevant to what we're talking about today. So we're talking about left-wing melancholia, and this is going to be a kind of different kind of topic for a lot of your listeners and my listeners here, because they've used to us being very concrete about things, and we are going to be. But this is more
vibes.
It's more a vibes. It's more the history of Marxism, and it's something that comes up periodically. It's first described by Walter Benjamin right before his death, in 2017. Interestingly, before we started declaring the death of the millennial, before everyone agreed that Chris Catrone was right about that, no one agrees with anything else he says, apparently. But
Gaza stuff, forget it.
Although, as I've told people, like, but Platypus has declared every left dead forever, like, as you know, so they're bound to be right eventually.
Except Lenin, right?
Yeah. But I do think this is a moment to look at this today because, I do think we're in a time period where there's a shock of recognition, and I'm gonna be talking about some things, and I'm using some terms from theory that we don't normally use. I'm gonna talk a little bit about hauntology, which has been made, you know, famous in left circles by Mark Fisher. It's really from a book by Derrida called Specters of Marx. Interestingly, about the same thing that we're experiencing now, which is the kind of death and rebirth of the need for something like Marx. And for even for a weird postmodern, post-structuralist liberal like Derrida, he actually towards the end of his life like mourned the loss of Marxism. That's in the Specters of Marx book, which was written pretty much as. And that book came out like as the Soviet Union was collapsing.
And also a time when like academic Marxism was kind of becoming the Marxism, certainly after like 89 or 91.
Yeah. And so also academic Marxism wasn't popular. Right. Like you had the autonomists, but by the time you get to like 89, 91, 92, the autonomists are, I don't think Negri and Hart are Marxist anymore by the time you get to that point, really. And
post-Marxist.
Yeah. I mean, they've gone through Eurocommunism, they've gone through Aporismo and Autonomia, and there's so much pulled in from post-structuralism in France and in Negri's case. That it's really, other than talk about real subsumption and stuff, not all that related to Marxism anymore.
Yeah,
they've abandoned labor theory of value. They've abandoned the working class as an actor. In some ways, they
returned to Marx so hard that they left him.
Right. and in some ways, they presage and postage communization. So so the communization of the 70s, you know, the first round of Duvet. weirdly does seem a lot like the more actionist insurrectionary version of the Lacroix move populism. And I know that's something I don't think people have like made that comparison before, but I think it's fair. Now, so in 2017, there are two bit pieces of writing that put left-wing melancholia back on the map. There's Enzo Traverso's book, Left-Wing Melancholia.
Can I raise my hand real quick?
Yeah, go ahead.
All right. So I would say too, because I've been thinking about this maybe in a, like a less theoretical way than you and more like an experiential sort of way. I want to give credit once more to the platypi, or I think what is a very interesting insight when it comes to left melancholia, which is that the left or even Marxists in many cases have become in a very basic way conservative and very much afraid of change. The way that society is changing itself, the way that geopolitics is changing, the way that American empire is declining, the way that the New Deal and post-New Deal order is in absolute flux right now. I feel like we, part of the melancholia that people feel is that this sort of post-1990s order that we've all lived under for decades now at this point in time, one that posited the end of history and for, you know, some decades there, maybe even felt like the end of history, is now collapsing before our eyes. And so that's very disorienting and very dismaying and brings, I think, people out of their comfort zones when it comes to politics. Like in the neoliberal era, you wanted to bring back the Fordist period. Well, now that the neoliberal era is in decline, are we going to try to bring back neoliberalism? Are we going to try to bring back globalization? Like, is it our job to look back to the last phase of capitalist development and try to reproduce that in like a more fair way or have that as our main political project? I think this, like, there's a lot to be afraid of and there's a lot to be melancholic about right now. But one thing that I think that we can maybe be optimistic about is that all regimes, regimes of accumulation, regimes of political power do fade away. And in the interregnum between them, and even like in their process of formation, there are moments where the working class always steps in and there's moments where working class militants and radicals can actually have an effect on that history as long as we're able to ride those winds of change as opposed to trying to hold them back and trying to defend elements of the capitalist order and the political order that seem comfortable to fight because we fought them for so long. This is a long-winded way of saying that others might be melancholy, but I'm actually not feeling very melancholy right now. And it's not just because I've been working 6 days a week, many, many hours, and I'm like, my brain is degraded and I've turned to rot. I think it's partially because there are interesting projects happening right now and interesting possibilities in this particular moment. That said, we need to see this melancholy, as you're pointing to, as a symptom of the moment and a symptom of the left. So that's what I would say before we get going.
I mean, well, there is a real fear on the left that the bad guys won a long time ago. And that what we're really doing is mitigating the damages and continued progression and decadence of capital. When most leftists would not actually articulate it this way. I would say partly because they don't have the language for it. But there's a kind of, from the Stalinists to the Social Democrats, and increasingly it's hard to, the Trotskyists, it's increasingly hard to tell the difference between them, honestly. Yeah. You see a fragmenting, and you see a free-floating theoretical apparatus. It's really kind of, at this point, a mixture of lame historical factoids and pretentious-ass jargon.
And meme theory.
Right.
Memes, yeah.
Right. Well, the pretentious jargon and the meme theory weirdly go together. Like, you get thrown some silly like memes in 2016, and all of a sudden you're reading Dominic Lasordo's like Stalin the Black Legend book or whatever. And people don't realize that, like, even if you agree with that book has a fundamentally conservative argument that Stalinism was necessary to undo the excesses of the left, and like that. Form of power is necessary as a reality check, to which I say that's, you are making a explicitly structurally conservative argument, and take it one step further, you'll be a liberal. Take it another step further, you'll be a conservative liberal. Take it one more step further, you'll be a reactionary, and it's structurally the same argument. Like, well, you know, you're running into the walls of reality. Well, you know, the obvious thing that the conservative says to the Stalinist is like, well, why did 1952 happen? How could Khrushchev betray like that? Blah, 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 blah. If it's not something in the thing already,
mm-hmm.
but that already there, that quote realization of power that you see, this comes from people who like to worship winners, but also have no idea what a winner is.
Right. Or even what they're fighting for.
Right. I mean, and you see this today, and I'm going to go through the conditions that we've seen, and I'll finish what I was mentioning about the two books. So Enzo Traverso's Left Melancholia, and then Wendy Brown did something called Resisting Left Melancholia based off the works of Stuart Hall. Mm. And I'm going to just go through we're not going to be talking about Enzo Traverso's book explicitly. But a lot of people associate Left Melancholia with the ultra left. And I actually think that's true in a couple of cases. And we might talk about that behind the Patreon wall, because we're going to be getting deep into socialist arcana if we go into that. But that actually, I think the turn towards practicality ends up being the most impractical move, and that destroys people.
Hmm.
Mark Fisher, David Graeber. I mean, David Graeber didn't die from melancholia. He died from unlucky diseases. But nonetheless, this is kind of, or I guess he had a brain hemorrhage. I can't remember.
Gut hemorrhage. I don't know.
Yeah. But unlucky. There was a way in which Graeber's politics got weirder and weirder and more incoherent.
Necessarily with the failure and decline of the Occupy Project, right?
Right. And you see this for him in even as early as 2004, but definitely by the time you get to the David and Ringo book. But I would say you see this actually really early. He keeps on redefining possibility lower and lower and lower and lower and lower. So one of the reasons why the occupations become a big deal for him is he starts believing that strategic retreat is a prefigurative politics. You can just live as if the government does not exist.
Yeah. I mean, it's like everyday communism, right?
Right.
He's arguing for in a Chomskyan way, right? That passing the salt to your sister at the dinner table is prefigurative of a new.
Right. And people don't realize, because they read the late, the Ringgrove book, it's like, oh, he's talking about all these other societies that were egalitarian, some of which I think his evidence is actually a little bit more scant than real. Mm. But on a lot of which I think are not, but he doesn't look at the conditions that produce them. He only looks at the mental landscape that produced them for the most part. Doesn't think about the relation that much, although occasionally it comes up as a shadow in that book, of material conditions and the mental landscape being related. Mm. He also wants to reject notions of human limit or even human animality. I mean, there is as pointed out by the radical anthropologist Chris Knight, there's a kind of refusal of Darwin throughout all of Graeber's work. So that's one example. The other example is the Mark Fisher, who starts off from a very post-Marxist but extremely radical place. And his most famous writings towards the end of his life, from the Vampire Castle forward, seem like they're rejecting contemporary politics, but they're actually him also rejecting his own ultra-leftism without saying he's doing it. Mm. Like Russell Brand as the possibility of joy through Corbynism.
Yeah.
Is a massive downshift of the demands actually made in capitalist realism as an analysis or other articles on K-punk. Mm-hmm. And so what you see is a more and more exuberant but also condemnatory rhetoric coming out of him, politics of joy and his ideas about mental illness. And
one of the maybe the headline questions here, right, is what was it about that generation, and now we're talking about Generation X, right, in both of these instances, that led to those projects being ultimately liquidated, or the more radical and autonomous and anarchist and ultra leftist projects ultimately liquidating themselves into another practical, pragmatic project, which of course is the return of neo-social democracy in the teens, whether Corbyn in Britain or Bernie in the United States. And what did that say about that entire politics? And what does it say to us now that politics has died again?
For me, this is where concepts like ontology actually do play out, because you look at the cycles when you see communization theory, all right, when communization theory emerges, what has happened? The classical left factions of the ultra left, which were Dutch German Council Communism and Italian left faction, which kind of splits into Bordigist and Dementist factions. Well, they've liquidated effectively. Like, they exist. They were completely quiet during the World War II, because in the Council Communists, most of them were killed and had to flee. In the case of the
Bordigist sects, right?
Yeah.
They remained, but they remained a half dozen people in smatterings of countries across the world, and in a very much a defensive posture, right? Holding right. on to a core cadre of people who hold on to a politics of the 19 teens and 20s, waiting for the Great Workers' Revolution.
Basically, Bordiga, I mean, people talk about it being more Lenin and Lenin and more Stalin and Stalin, but Bordiga is what happens when you take Leninism, make it more intransient, and also say we're freezing it at its height of, say, 1914 to 1917.
They're not doing anything that other Leninists didn't do either, right? And Trotsky is certainly
right. Well, I mean, and
we're still in the era of monopoly capital, the final stage of capitalism,
right? When you think about this also, that they thought that they could hold on to an invariant program. Initially, Bordiga and the Trotskyists are actually somewhat aligned in the early 1920s, but they end up rejecting each other despite Bordiga's defense of Trotsky himself, which is
Trotsky's defense of Lenin and Bordiga's defense of Lenin, right? They're both appealing to Lenin, but offering like an alternative Leninism to right. what happens in the 1930s, actually in power, right?
Right. And I think if we look at the 1970s as a result of the... to do a little bit of very quick history, I break the new left down into three phases. I admit that this is kind of arbitrary, but when I do it, people will see why and maybe how to help them understand today. The left in the Europe in the 1950s is capitulated to the humanism of the post-Khrushchev Soviet Union, but they keep on by wanting to make detente with national powers and creating individual roads to socialism. They keep actually pushing the parties aligned to the Cominform, which is sort of the successor to the Comintern. Even more explicitly about, USSR foreign policy than the Comintern was. But definitely the parties who were tied to the Comintern formally. The ones that survive and thrive, mainly France and Italy, take on the tone of we are the popular front, we help save the nation. And then they basically go something like a patriotic socialist route. Not a national socialist route, because that was still seen as a problem, or a national Bolshevik to separate them from Nazis. Let's be clear here.
They were claiming the mantle of the foundational event of the second half of the 20th century, which was the defeat of the Nazis, right?
Right.
So you have two competing powers. You have the liberal ruling class, and then you have the Soviet-oriented communist parties, both saying that no, it is actually our victory, and we are the ones who will ultimately prevail.
Right. But the problem that you also have is that it was a joint effort that was unforeseen by either side. Like, Stalin was preparing for war as early as the 30s, but he wasn't preparing for war with Nazi Germany. Not immediately. The first war he thought he was going to have was with Britain and the United States. And it's pretty clear when you look at what he's doing, who he thinks he's preparing for war with. That ends up, in a lot of ways, gutting the leadership of the USSR. I mean, and I think this is something that Marxist-Leninists today do not want to look at. It's like, well, all you had was Beria, literally a child rapist,
yeah,
and Khrushchev as key figures left. Molotov was useless, and there's no old Bolsheviks left. They were all liquidated. So who
made Khrushchev?
Who made Rufus and Rufus? like, and this leads to this weird thing that you see in the East Asian communist bloc, where there is a critique of Stalin, but there's a bigger critique of the Soviet Union. So Stalin becomes a figurehead for them for when things were better. But when you really push their writings, they're actually critiquing events and things that started during the Stalin period, not during the Khrushchev period. Like what led to the Sino-Soviet split goes all the way back to Stalin picking the Kuomintang to represent the Chinese left and the Comintern and not the Chinese Communist Party.
Famously getting liquidated in Shanghai.
Right. So this leads to, in Europe, you have this left that is associated with both the USSR, but also in France and Italy, they're associated with the liberal state, like fundamentally.
And at the United States too.
Right. And at times they actually pivot, you know, to the right of the Socialist Party or, you know, or other various left formations to maintain that relationship, which actually leads to, like, if you, by the time you get to the late 60s, well, why are there so many French post-Marxists, right? Like, what's with that? It's a lot of them are super frustrated with how milquetoast the, not just the Socialist Party was, but the Communist Party was. And yet they were also rejecting Mao spandex, that weird, you know, libertarian form of Maoism is pretty much unique to France. They were rejecting the ultra-left, which was so tiny that most people didn't know about it. They were rejecting new ultra-lefts that developed, like the Situationists and the Letterists.
Yeah.
Yeah, these groups that were also largely coming out of art movements, like they had some relationship to working classness. I don't want to say that there was none, but they were highly tied to artistic movements. So, and anti-communism became really strong, ironically, in the governments that these society, you know, these communist parties were tied to in Europe. And then the United States, the Communist Party, some of this, we do have to be honest, their weird movings around, their refusal to like admit their agenda, and a lot of the union organizing for good and bad reasons, the total seeming incoherence of their relationship to the U.S. as a, like, rhetorically, you have both the pink glasses William C. Foster Stalinism, but you also had like the beginnings of what was going to be like America bad.
Look, Charles de Gaulle was a much better anti-American than the Communist Party of France. Let's be clear about that in practical terms, right?
Right.
And, you know, the old dream of like Gorder, of like having like organic individual like communist road to powers in the developed, you know, Western European and American format actually does kind of become real in like the nationally specific popular fronts and the ways that all the different communist parties liquidate themselves into it, or at least become subordinate to the liberal state in the post-war era, whether that's the New Deal in the United States, whether that's Gaullist Derridism in France, or whether that's the Christian Democrats and the welfare state built in Germany. In each of these instances, of course, like the left becomes a subordinate partner in this. They have their autonomy, but their autonomy to do one thing, which is to acquaint themselves with the liberal state.
Right. And so, and the leftists are thanked for that early in the United States, earlier than in Europe, by liquidation. I mean, they're not killed, but they are, you know, starting as early as 1948, which is the high point of the Communist Party. You start seeing Democrats push back on them. By the time you get the Eisenhower regime, the only thing that really distinguishes the Eisenhower regime from the New Deal regime in a lot of ways is their rabid pursuit internally of communist factions and making sure that, oh, well, you know, this strategic and tactical alliance after World War II, this is over. And so we have
to, that's McCarthyism, obviously, right? People who don't get the reference. So every nation has its unique road, not towards socialism, but towards liquidating itself into a popular front,
right,
under either Stalinist terms or just like milquetoast social democratic terms.
And for me, this leads to the first round of left melancholia, which is where like monopoly capital theory emerges from in some ways. Of Bernard Sweezy, you see stuff in the 50s where you have some people who, you know, Frankfurt School or whatever, just like, well, it's all bad. There is no good left. And if anything, You see this in late Horkheimer and a little bit in Adorno, and you don't see it at all in Marcuse, but like this idea that like, well, maybe we should just be furthering the bourgeois revolutions. Mm-hmm. That's implied, even though the bourgeois revolutions are still bad. In fact, you know, if you read Adorno, there really is a way in which negative dialectics is saying everything is fascist now. Mm. But maybe there's enough left in the core of bourgeois idealism that we could do something. You know, Lukács is talking about them being on Hotel Grand Abyss because of this, right? Because this is a wave of melancholy, but it's not unique to them. Like, that's the major manifestation of it. The other thing that happens is a lot of the partisans get sucked up in the Congress of Cultural Freedom.
CIA front, right?
Yeah. And it's an anti-communist front that's willing to use socialists to, like, you know, end radical theory, etc. Here's the interesting thing. There's no indication that anybody knew that exactly. Like we, even though ironically Marcuse worked for the precursor organization to the CIA explicitly, he did so because of the anti-fascist move. And also we have to remind ourselves, when Marxist Leninists bring this up, that like we were allied with the Soviet Union. And as soon as that was over, that a lot of those Frankfurt School people left. But the people that people focus on as being the most conservative elements of that generation of Frankfurt School, Horkheimer and Adorno, have no formal relationship to the CIA that's ever been proven.
Yeah, somebody like George Orwell, right, who works with the OSS and MI6, is I don't know what you'd call him, a libertarian socialist, right? It's clear by his political trajectory that the horrors of the 1930s and the Second World War and the Spanish Civil War, of course, were going to lead him to become like a British Scoop Jackson, you know, a neoconservative, which is a path that a lot of people take. Given the bifurcation of world politics at that time and the liquidation of any sort of independent, autonomous working class organizations that could overcome the Stalinism, right?
So left melancholia in the 50s is very real, in that all the parties start to dramatically shrink. And in the case of the U.S., it's because of a few reasons. The biggest one's the Red Scare. The second one is the high concentration of communists, actually, ironically, considering the association of the right and left coast in New York City and California with communism is actually fair, because historically speaking, on the records that we have on the Communist Party of the United States was keeping records, they're after the 20s. In the 20s, they're actually strong in the Midwest. But after the 20s, they're really highly concentrated in these immigrant urban areas that are also highly educated. And that's going to be LA, the Bay Area, and New York, even that early.
Yeah.
So they're also geographically concentrated.
Demographically concentrated by way of geography.
Right. And they're also, I mean, they're associated with Jews for a reason.
Europeans for a reason. And, you know.
Right. Yeah. So some of which is, you know, used to ill. I know that we're talking about left wing melancholia today, but like there's a reason in the 1950s where this is a very real period of like of confusion, because outside of where revolutions are supposed to happen, they're happening. But where revolutions are supposed to be happening, they're getting crushed, or they're not starting in the first place. So the German situation is that it's crushed. The Italian and French situation is that it never, ever happens. And weirdly, they also seem to be defending the status quo, a status quo that is in some ways explicitly anti-communist.
Yeah, and not to mention too that this is a couple generations after the split between official socialism and communism, which you know, in 1914 becomes a split that in the United States it kind of happened before the First World War, right? But like the breaking up of these two tendencies within the working class movement leads to not just disorientation, but in the United States and elsewhere also leads to like the sort of the memory holding of a lot of like indigenous working class activity from the 19th and early 20th century, that the 1950s can't recapitulate, right? You can't bring that back. You can't like try to like reform the Farmers Workers Alliance or something like that under these new conditions.
Absolutely. And I think that's part of why in the American left today, there's like a very piss poor understanding of the left before the 1940s. Really, we do, like maybe people kind of understand the. There's been more research into the high point of the Communist Party in the 20s and early 30s, and then in the Popular Front period where it was huge. But also,
that's a new left historiography, right? That's like the new social history historiography. That is like the painting of the Communist Party as like the natural successor to the Socialist Party, which, you know, was argued died out for reformist reasons or whatever the new left case for that might be. It's a way to recapitulate the choices made in the 1920s and 1930s for the post-war era.
Right. So as we go into the 60s, and I want to bring in a couple of theoretical concepts. We have left-wing melancholia, that's Wetzer Benjamin. That's actually obviously what it means. What's associated with it is interesting, and I think the person who's the best at really talking about the conditions that we view as its effect on the individual psyche, and some of these are going to sound very familiar to us today, I think. Left melancholy is manifested in a spirit of guilt for not challenging authority enough. See the 50s. In the fear of surrendering in disarray and resignation, the Hotel Grand Abyss, see the Frankfurt School. In mourning the human cost of the past not paying off, see the cost of World War II, both in Russia and in the West. And in the sense of there being no way to realize utopian aspirations, right? Like these are the tendencies that Traverso sees define it. Traverso, so like you, actually sees this that there is something good in this, and that they actually also provide you with the resources to break with current trends and current path dependencies and what he calls regimes of history into a new mode of operations. All right. So this is where the new left is so important, but let's actually talk about this. Cause I think a lot of people, like I hear people tell me, like, oh, the new left was mostly Marxist and Leninist. And I'm like, no, what absolutely was not. Mm-mm. All right.
Students for a Democratic Society or the Port Huron statement. I mean,
yeah. Or the Combahee River Collective, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The new communist movement, which is in the final phase of the new left, is Marxist and Leninist. But it's also where we start seeing American anarchism come back again and stuff like that. So let me talk about the phases. So we talked about the preconditions for this. In Europe, this leads to a bunch of rebellions that weirdly do one thing. For example, people have often talked about how like Maoism ends up being the Trotskyism of France. And that's partly because the French Communist Party doubled down so much on allegiance to like Soviet humanism that the way to critique that was to go and reach out to people who were beginning to split off from the like communist bloc and see the movement in the non-aligned movement and in the Sino-Soviet split as an era to as a way to critique the conservatism of the French Communist Party itself, which also is weird because it does lead to like a Maoism that's actually weirdly divorced from actual Maoism, because they don't know that much about what's going on.
Yeah, like, Maoism is gesture. Like, how do you understand in France in the 1960s the Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution, which wasn't even really understood in China in many cases at that time, right? It's like this fervent kind of outpouring of attacks against the bureaucracy and attacks against genetically ruling class members of the party and things of that sort. I use that advisedly and ironically, right? But like May 68, of course, is like the explosion of all of this, right? It's these tensions breaking out into the open. It's a civil war within the left.
Right. And in America, this is where separating the French and the French story and the Italian story. In Italian, you also have this. Mm-hmm. This happens in, weirdly, unlike in France, which is about students, what happens in Italy, actually, unlike the rest of the case studies, is about workers. Mm-hmm. Workers get pissed off that sectional bargaining seems to like somehow hurt more workers than help by that point, because the bargaining sections like ignore local conditions and specific needs. So this leads to a workerism operismo, the operators, maybe also is the way you can translate that.
And the localist one too, right? Like self-organized workers of Turin, for example, like in the auto manufacturing industry organize themselves around like sectoral and local lines.
Right.
like a bunch of those all the way across northern Italy.
So that happened. So that's an interesting thing that leads to eventually to Autonomia as Operismo. Is initially actually, and people are confused by this, because it's associated today with ultra-left tendencies in Italy, but it actually has no relationship to the Italian ultra-left at all, other than like historical markers. Like the left faction in the 20s was super big in Turin. But like Operismo is not pulling from Bordiga or Dement or the left or the Communist Party international movements or anything else.
Which is fascinating and like an indictment of the Bordigist model, right? Like if there was ever a time and a moment for like this kind of crystallized 19-teens, 1920s, like uber-Leninism to come to the fore, it would have been this moment, right?
Right. Instead, it doesn't. Interestingly, Bordigists have a lot more influence in the radicalization of France when stuff like the Situationist International seems to go nowhere. So the Situationist International are dissident, but they're not Trotskyists. They're a different group. And like we mentioned earlier, they're mostly tied to the Arch, which means when stuff happened with the students, they were already there. And so them and Mao Spandex, these Maoists, kind of become the two facing out versions of what May 68 means. And of course the non-Maoist ones are going to be more famous in America.
Just watch a Godard movie if you want to know about that stuff.
Right. So that happens. And in America, you have a weird phenomenon that's kind of unique. Regionally speaking, the new left actually begins in the early 60s, coming out of the civil rights movement radicalizing. And it comes out of black power activists who are leaving the CPUSA angry. Some of them get involved in the Congress of Cultural Freedom, like Richard Wright, but others become like Stokely Carmichael and people who kind of flirt with the CPUSA and end up like, and go, no, we're going to be paying Africanists.
And some of them eventually become Jay Sakai.
Right. Well, yeah, eventually. But that's way later. So what initially happens is there is a bunch of Midwestern schools. Remember, I mentioned way back that early on, the industrial Midwest was actually the heart of the CPUSA. That was not true by World War II. But for whatever reason, some of it having the historical ties to these old socialist movements, some of it being that who the fuck cares about the Midwest? The Midwestern universities in specific were not fully de-leftified the way actually the elite universities that we associate with the left and that Buckley was complaining about in the 50s actually had. I mean, like, the left that Buckley's complaining about in the 50s is like conservative Keynesianism.
That's not where the civil rights radicalism comes out of. It comes from like an older, like late 19th, early 20th century tradition of like the Highlander schools and like Quaker radicalism, the ACLU, this right. sort of civil liberties socialism that like survive and communism that survives, like you said, in the Midwest in smaller regions and like is able to create and recreate cadre as the conditions change.
So in some ways, from the Marxist perspective, these tendencies are weird and we would actually kind of, we would associate them with the, not the Lovestoneites and the formal left opposition, but like from the standpoint of both official and left-wing communism, these people would have been actually by our standards, fairly right-wing, but they were not suppressed or purged as much. So out of like Rutgers and Wisconsin, you have like a bunch of Marx adjacent sociologists and lawyers, people like Staunton Lind, C. Wright Mills, those guys.
You had
Chomsky.
To mention like indigenous, like workerists, like Studs Terkel, right?
Who is
Chicago, right?
And you had all these old, at this point, people who had come up during the New Deal and were like old New Deal romantics, basically. Yeah. They glom on and lead the initial wave of the New Left Students for the Democratic Society, whatever. They're like the big thinkers. Some of them start getting interested in Marxism around 1965-66, but they're interested in like dissident forms of Marxism. So for example, Eugene Genovese, later on reactionary, but he's obsessed with
the only Marxist who read so much slave history started to like
side with the Confederacy.
Side with the Confederacy, yeah. Incredible stuff.
But nonetheless, he he was really interested in Eurocommunism. And someone told me that his running into conservatism was as much about Italian Eurocommunism failing as it was about the Soviet Union failing. So
a brain explosion right there.
Yeah. So that's Genovese. You have Lashes from the school.
Great historian of slavery, by the way. I really did enjoy reading Genovese back in the day. Eugene Genovese, guys, read him before he gets reactionary.
Yeah. It's also interesting to read him as he gets reactionary. But nonetheless, but it's interesting because he never actually says slavery is good, like ever.
He points to the patriarchal like relations of slavery as preferable in that instance to the wage slavery of the North. Right. That's his argument, I think, if I remember.
No, eventually he just says, like, towards the end of his life, he's like, well, Confederates were arguing for a more humane social order in the agrarian order. And if they could have done it without slavery, it would have been worth supporting. So this is this kind of like
which is a real like dark sided view, because it's an interesting view because it's like a very non-Marxist view, right? Like you're arguing that somehow you could have an alternative form of agrarian development that would not be led by the bourgeoisie, but instead right. a different like landowning class.
Yeah. Which I mean basically it's neo-medievalism. Right.
A lot of people on Twitter who are like that these days.
Right.
Rightists.
I mean, that's one digression of where this goes, but these were the people who initially come up. One of the reasons why the CPUSA, weirdly, the CPUSA have been decimated. It went from 75,000 to like 10,000 in less than a decade.
Yeah, half of which were informants.
Right. And by the time you get to the new left, during the 60s, what happens is the Sino-Soviet split leads a lot of these groups to split off. So like the RCP by Bob Avakian fame splits off first with like a workers movement that's a more militant communist movement.
Bay Area something or other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then they form the RCP. While that's interesting is these splinter groups meet these post-civil rights groups and these student protests, beginning the anti-war protests, you know, liberal radicals, and they form with them. Eventually they take over the SDS, the RCP in particular, and try to move it in a Maoist direction. This basically dissolves the SDS.
Dissolves it into like a terrorist wing and a new communist wing.
Right. Well, you have a terrorist wing, a new communist wing, but most people are just deactivated by it.
Right.
Like Occupy. Right. So what you have is, the thing about the SDS is the SDS is both like Occupy and its reliance on protests, and people should be wary of that right now. But different in that it was an actual organization that had goals more like the DSA. And I've always said that the DSA is the DSA of the aught teens. It's true. Predecessor is not the old DSA. It's actually the SDS, which is like an incoherent, real movement. And I think, and I'm not, when I say it's incoherent, a lot of people think I'm condemning it. I actually think it's a real movement that's trying to find itself in that those conflicting tensions being all held within it was initially a good thing. It was an attempt to top down impose a program that didn't emerge from it itself that shuttered it down.
I'm very sympathetic with that. I think that something like that is inevitable after the defeats that we were just speaking about in the 20th century, right? And given the demographic basis, the class basis of the organization, incoherences seems at least like a necessary stage to pass through. Whether breaking into a Maoist, Marxist-Leninist direction and liquidating the organization, whether that was a wise move is up to question. Maybe it was inevitable or something like that.
And Trotskyist emerged out of it, Maoist emerged out of it. Basically, all the sectarian emergent stuff that had been brewing in these old sects, the CPUSA being very old by this point, I was reading that like the average CPUSA member was like 10 to 15 years older than the average leftist, period. Mm. And then in this time period, so they also just weren't recruiting youth people at all. And you had then the Black Power movement caused a massive cadre of the black elements of the CPUSA, which was kind of its cultural uniqueness and powerhouse in the United States. It had protected and fostered African-American art scenes, African-American political cadres for a long, long time. Basically, if you weren't in the black churches or the black Muslim movement, you were in the Communist Party.
Right.
So if you weren't Martin Luther King or Malcolm X, you were Paul Robeson.
Right.
And
the boys.
Right. But by the 60s, you see these people defecting in mass, starting with people like Ralph Ellison, but Richard Wright, James Baldwin, all these artists and people associated with the neo-Harlem Renaissance movement and black arts and the beginnings of black power movement. But then you also have leaders like Amiri Baraka, who's young at this point, Harry Cruz, etc. You know, Harry Cruz like starts calling the CPUSA like basically a crypto Jewish nationalist movement. Like you have this break with these black organizations. The Panthers is younger. They're there. They are class-based, but they're actually also responding against this whole movement of like Panthers are interesting because they both are representative of this black power movement, but they're also breaking from it in key ways. And they're internally divided amongst themselves. Mm-hmm. So
also a relatively incoherent, despite their amazing propaganda and their like direct activity, also somewhat incoherent.
Oh yeah. I mean, well, some of them are Pan-Africanists, some of them are black nationalists, some of them are
Maoists.
I mean, a lot of them were Maoists because they were getting money from China.
Yeah. They were getting free little red books right off the boat there in the Bay Area. Go down, open up that secret shipping container, you'll find like 1,000 little red books.
Right. But this leads to two things which happen. One is the sects that we know them today really start emerging. This is when the Trotskyist party started splitting in response to World War II, but they really both emerge and start splitting with each other like crazy. And if you look at the Trotskyist old chart, like they go nuts in the 60s. Like that's when there's like just a huge array of Trotskyist movements.
Now, Trotskyist, and not just in the US, but globally, of course.
Right, yeah. But Trotskyist movements in the US are in an interesting position, right? We talk about how they were used by the CIA later on, and they were, by the way, that's true. But they also had their own like historiography because they weren't wedded to the popular front.
Mm-hmm.
They had a different reading of what happened in the end of World War II, and it was very appealing to people who had seen. Well, we sided with these people. We helped them. We helped John Lewis build the AFL-CIO, and how did we get thanked? We got fucking purged.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
So the Trotskyists who did not do that, but also had unions, look pretty good. And the official Comintern policy, and this will seem weird today since, you know, Marxist Lenin has never shut the fuck up calling everyone Trotskyites or whatever, but like
the Trotskyists at least had the Minneapolis general strike, man. That's not enough.
But the other thing is the Trotskyists were under order. I mean, not Trotskyists, the Marxist-Leninists were under order just not to engage with them at all.
Pretend they didn't exist.
Yeah, so they kind of got left unanswered. So they have become important. And then there is a rebirth of Marxist-Leninism, but almost none of it is from the CPUSA itself. The CPUSA doesn't get on that action until the 72. It does grow. Like the CPUSA membership jumps from like about 7,000 to about 20,000. During the early 70s. But the new communist movement, which is largely Marxist-Leninist or Hojist, Marxist-Leninist or Hojist really emerges. But they don't pull from, in America, they do not pull from the Soviet Union very much. They mostly pull from
Albania, China,
dissident factions, because they're, again, rebelling against the seeming conservatism of the CPUSA and the CPUSA's maintenance of the popular front for fucking ever.
And, like, of course, too, the context of the 1950s, 60s and 70s, which is decolonization non-aligned movement and the rise of various either like liberal theories or radical theories of like what this moment means.
Yeah. Right. So what happens with these groups is they try to enter and salt the unions in the early 70s. Because the terrorist wing part of them doesn't really work. The weathermen, the yippies, what do they mostly do? They blow themselves up. And then you also had this like merger with elements of the hippies as represented by like the Yippie movement and some of the other more wild movements, like High Times is actually tied into this.
And then later in a more reformist way, like the Clamshell Alliance.
Yeah.
Like ladies trying to keep the Hudson River, trying to rejuvenate watersheds and sort
of. Right. So again, you have
anti-nuclear, of course, too. Later. I keep talking this into the 80s.
You have all this stuff coming out. But what's also coming out, and someone like Lauren Goldner will point out, is all these groups have to facing up that they're not telling the complete truth about what's going on in East Asia, that they are, they don't know. That communist unity is also not just impossible theoretically, even within the Marxist-Leninist movement, but also that Marxist-Leninists are literally killing each other in mass in Southeast Asia between the Cambodian Vietnam War. Something that, you know, our current batch of internet Marxist-Leninists today don't want to look at all. Or if they do, they're like, we got to defend Pol Pot, but not talk about why.
You and me should do an episode on the Sino-Soviet split. Like, I think you've pointed this out in several episodes before, that it's just this giant blind spot. And as this weird like neo-Marxism Leninism, which papers over all the sort of differences of the 20th century as it continues to take hold in, like, I don't know what, MAGA communism or Midwest Marxism or whatever it is, that would maybe be a good thing for us to look into and kind of try to nail down a little bit for the listeners.
Yeah. So I think what you see there in the cycles of the new left, by the time you get to the 80s, you're right. This is all recapitulated. The Maoists are becoming the basis of the new progressive parts of the Democrats.
They're becoming black mayors in small post-industrial towns throughout the, you know, the Rust Belt.
Right. The remnants of the CPUSA have divided amongst themselves, and the CPUSA really embarrassed itself in the 1950s. I mean, CPA, excuse me, not USA. That's later. Of the CPA, not CPA. Blech. Getting all these are all too close.
The certified public accountant.
Yeah,
maybe a lot of communists just became CPAs.
That's the awesome. SPA. There we go. Which was a rump party, but actually did okay as kind of siding with the like Marx-ish Skip Jacksonites, because they started really pushing American exceptionalism. They really doubled down on their right wing character. The Trotskyists enter them, actually, a faction of the Trotskyists enter them, actually, in the mid-60s. And by 68, it basically kills, I mean, Shachtman ends SPA, it doesn't have a reason for existing. That leads to the birth of the SPUSA, which is what I got my various too many letters that are the same.
Doesn't it also lead, of course, to the LaRoucheites, the Schiller Institute and whatnot?
Later, you're way jumping ahead.
I keep trying to jump. Keep going.
I mean, it also led to Commentary Magazine. I mean, like, it really did lead to
neoconservatism.
A bunch of former Social Democrats and Trotskyists. It wasn't just Trotskyists. Weirdly, Marxist-Leninists actually today often pick up an explicitly anti-Semitic conspiracy theory from paleoconservative right about Trotskyists and neoconism.
Pat Buchanan calls. He wants his structural anti-Semitism back.
they have often picked it up just directly.
Yeah.
Because their whole thing is like, well, the more Jewish end of the Marxist movement was the Trotsky. And therefore, that's why they're neoconservatives and blah, 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 blah.
I'm much structural about that, to be honest.
You have this birth of neoconservatism, but it doesn't see itself as that yet. You also have the birth of the Social Democratic movement in America, literally. I mean, that's what the Harrington forms a group, Social Democratic movement. It merges with another thing from the 70s. The New American Movement. The New American Movement came out of Peter Camejo's looking at the field of Maoists and Trotskyists and whatever and going, look, there's way too many of us. Like, there's too many different groups. And also, like, none of us are in the Soviet Union. We all have critiques, but most of us are Soviet defensists. Even the Trotskyists are defending the Soviet Union ultimately. So we should form a new political formation. Camejoism basically creates two new political formations. One is the Green Party. And the other is the New American Movement, which merges with the Social Democratic Movement in the early 1980s to give us the DSA that protected Bernie Sanders and and Barbara Ehrenreich and that whole new left center, center right on the socialist spectrum. I'm not saying they're center right, but they're center right for socialists. Tradition is born, all right, and it kind of sees itself as a rump tradition, and it although it does have a lot of success initially in New York specifically. I mean, they basically
hired David Dinkins. I remember him well from when I was a kid. DSA.
And they see their kind of movement as starting with like left populism review and renewal, which is what Harrington was pushing, ironically critiqued by Christopher Lash. He became a pro-populist later. That's a different, different story. But the left populist movement, which throws itself behind the McGovern campaign. Well, the DSA does it again. And we forget this in the Jesse Jackson campaigns. Like Bernie Sanders wasn't the first time this was attempted.
The Rainbow Coalition. Folks. Right. Look it up.
So what does this have to do with today's left melancholia? And I'm going to give how this all ties in and what is led to real fast and brief. Then we can go behind the Patreon and really get into detail. But like, you have basically the right wingish end of the socialist movement. And again, when I say right wing, I just mean like they're pulling from Keynes and Schopenhauer as much as Marx. And the Marxist tradition, if they are open and identify with, is not the Soviet Union, and it's not China. And so what do they have left? Well, this is where you start seeing like the Nordic model being picked up on American talking points on the left. And we need to double down and like kind of guide the new Gen X progressives. And these are the people who are the mentors to people like Graeber and Mark Fisher. So they're coming out of a left that has a lot of its Marxist content really removed, even though it tried to reassert itself in the prior decade. But the other thing, there's a lot of those more like officially Maoist, Trotskyist, etc., Leninist cadre members had become in the 80s and 90s all over the political spectrum. They have been reabsorbed into the normal political spectrum. David Horowitz becomes a neoconservative, was a Maoist. Bob Reich was a Maoist, became, you know, the Rob Reich of today. You know, tied to the Clinton administration. Like, so that recapitulation was obvious to people. And weirdly, the right wing of that movement did not capitulate as much. It had actually somehow, by staying the same, ended up being the representative of the left. So you had this cycle where this right wing Marxianness began the new left. It also ends the new left. And how does that lead to us today, and what melancholy is there today? Well, there's more history. We're going to talk about this, like, because the new ultra left tendencies that often influenced America that became popular after Occupy were mostly born, ironically, in the 70s after 68 in response to this stuff, and kind of went dormant for a long time. And when I've written about Bordigism and its weird history and its revival and this, that, and the other, you start to see that. There's a lot of like left communist organization. There were major left communist conferences for the first time since before World War II. In the 70s. So there is this shadow recognition of the problem. The other thing that starts happening is people start digging into older and older left traditions to distance themselves from the Soviet Union, you know,
the Stalin period
stuff, the Popular Front, the lame stuff in Maoism.
Bernie Sanders.
Right. Maoism and splinters too. Maoism and splinters in the three different movements, which today, ironically today, none of them are actually represented by what we call Maoist anymore. But you had the Maoist internationalist, the Marxist-Leninist Maoist movement, socialism and that's later. Mao Zedong thought, and Marxist internationalist Maoism, and
I'll go through the Shining Path people, right?
No,
that's right. The MLM people. All right, let's take it behind the paywall.
Let's take it behind the paywall.
We'll take a short break, and then if you're interested in how I'm wrong and how Varn's gonna pull this whole new history of Maoism out, you want to become a patron of the Antifada and also a Varn vlog. We are going to talk a bunch more behind the paywall. This was a great history that you presented. I hope that my desire to pull us into the 1980s over and over again didn't screw it up, but
no,
get into it on the other side. Thank you, everybody. We'll see you there.